You're listening to the World Soccer Talk podcast, the only podcast about watching soccer on TV and online. Welcome to episode 174. Coming up on this week's show, ESPN gives German soccer a boost, insight into the MLS Orlando tournament and what it means for soccer fans, Fanatis launches a free version of their streaming service, Amazon adds a new highly recommended soccer documentary, plus we have letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. I'm Christopher Harris, aka The Gaffer, joined alongside my co-host Kartik Krishnire. Kartik, let's dive right into what we've been watching from this past week, and probably you, like myself and many of our listeners, we've been flying the flag of Germany and the Bundesliga, still watching the league and seeing how good of a job the TV production's been in terms of everything, in terms of the coronavirus and following the correct guidelines. Everything seems to be pretty flawless.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, though, that I've fallen into this trap, which seems very contradictory and maybe hypocritical of me based on our conversations at the beginning of coronavirus, into watching absolutely every Premier League Classic match NBCSN is airing. So there's been that viewing as well. And part of it, Chris, I will admit, is watching old Premier League productions. Some of the commentators, Steve Banyard now has been on a number of them. And we've gone through the last few weeks, others, Craig Burley as a co-commentator, et cetera, that you don't get on Premier League broadcasts very much, very often anymore. So that's been part of the thrill for me, is listening to older commentators. And then genuinely kind of reconnecting with a lot of footballers in that era of the Premier League. And NBCSN has shown classic matches from all eras, but it's generally been from about 2009 to 2015 that they've focused on. So late Fox Soccer Channel / ESPN2 era, and then the early NBC era, if you want to date it in U.S. television terms. So reconnecting with a lot of older players or players that may have been young then and are now in the prime or on the downswing of their careers, as well as some guys that, quite honestly, we sometimes forget about. Matthew Flamini, for instance, those sorts of guys. Raul Morales, Colo Torre, guys that were very good players for a period of time at big clubs that sometimes just fade into in the memories and obscurities. I mean, obviously, Colo Torre is now an assistant with Brendan Rodgers at Leicester, so he's still kind of there, but we forget about him as a player. So that's been a lot of fun for me, in addition to watching the Bundesliga like everybody else. And I feel like an awful hypocrite for it, Chris, but part of it is looking at the production quality, looking at the commentators from that era, the graphics from Premier League productions, which would change with every time they negotiated a new television package. Remember, there would be these slight tweaks to it, which I've kind of gotten into hyper-analyzing, and then seeing the graphics and saying, okay, I know when this game was. This game would have been in such and such a year, because that was when they were using that graphics package. The sort of thing that, like, media – I guess I would consider myself a media and TV
critic,
sportscasting geek, right? Critic, but geek also would get into that. I guess most people wouldn't.
Well, I think there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I've been doing the same, but to a different era and going back to, like, I'm a little bit older than you, I think, Kartik, and back to the early 80s, still watching some of the Match of the Day programs that are on YouTube. And just for me, it's more of a looking at how things have changed, the style of football, you mean the kits, the stadiums, the hooliganism, and the policing, and the football, the types of goals, you mean kind of more long range efforts, and the style of play. So analyzing the game from a different way. So I think, yeah, there's nothing wrong with going back and watching the NBC. You know, kind of best of all the different years and stuff like that. I think it's a worthwhile effort too, and it also reminds us a lot too, no matter what era or no matter what league or what team or what we're watching, is that there's a lot of history, there's a lot of things that happened before the present day. Speaking of which, Kartik, last night, I don't think you've seen it, and I didn't tell you anything about it, so this is completely brand new and live. is I think Amazon released a bunch of new videos on that, their Amazon Prime Video service, because there was a bunch of new soccer stuff that came up in my recommended list. And one of them I was flipping through, and it was called Do You Want to Win? Question mark. And I thought, well, let me check that out. It was spectacular. So superb. It's the story of Leeds United and the turnaround. It's a documentary about the turnaround from the team that was in the 1980s, had been relegated, I think, under Alan Clark, and were really at a low from the highs of it being in the 60s and 70s with a classic team under Don Revie. Brian Clough, of course, even for that short spell. But in the late 80s, relegated, running out of money, having a huge hooliganism problem, having a huge racist problem within the supporters, and how Howard Wilkinson was hired as manager. And that from then on, just talking about what he did to that team in terms of changing the club around, the mindset and everything. And getting promoted from the second tier to what was then the first division, and then within a couple of years winning the very last final first division title before it became the Premier League in 1992. And there's interviews with Vinnie Jones, Gordon Strachan, Howard Wilkinson. Mm-hmm. There's quite a bit of time spent about Gary Speed, David Batty, I think Mel Stirland, a lot of these like really iconic Leeds United supporters, players. And the thing that I like the most about it is it really captures the football culture, really, from the fans to the players to the chairman. A real-life documentary, really well done. And again, I'm not a Leeds United supporter by any means, but I highly recommend this one.
That sounds amazing, Chris, because I think it's also important, and you talked about the match of the days you've been watching from the early 1980s. I think it's important for fans of younger fans, newer fans of English football to understand the 1980s and how football was kind of a pariah game in England at the time, how some of the classic clubs who had done so well in the 1960s and 70s, Chelsea, Leeds, Manchester City, the 80s were horrible decades for all those clubs. For Manchester City, it started a little later. The early 80s were okay, and then it dipped in 1983. There has been this thought of me as a Manchester City supporter of actually doing something on the 1980s and Manchester City because it was such a bad decade. And I actually recently, for our friend Rami Sofi, had a questionnaire I answered for him about Manchester City and Manchester City history. And one thing that came up in it for me was, who are your greatest players ever? I was asked. And obviously you think of now Sergio Aguero, David Silva. Going back, you think of Summerby, you think of Colin Bell, and you think of Franny Lee. And Franny Lee was the chairman of Manchester City during that period, during the really bad period in the late 80s, early 90s. And I said, you know, he might be our greatest player ever, but no Manchester City supporter will say it because of his job as the president of the club. So that era, I think, is important for people to learn about. And Leeds had a huge hooligan problem. The city itself was going through this horrible period in terms of job losses and strife and trade union issues. There's a period of Leeds United history from about 1978 to 1990 where they're off the boil. So, or 1988-89. So I actually really look forward to watching this. And I think you could make a similar documentary about Chelsea, who had all kinds of problems in the 1980s. And Manchester City, Manchester United to a lesser extent. I mean, they were still competitive, though. I think they were more competitive than the other clubs I mentioned. United's problems were really in the 70s after Sir Matt Busby retired for the final time. But yeah, this sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
And I look forward to watching it.
Yeah, some good footage in there, too. And the thing is about the Premier League and NBC's SN is this is a type of program that I think that they probably would never show because it has no connection to the Premier League, even though technically, I mean, it's the same division and it just got, I mean, completely changed and ripped out of the Football League and put it and kind of rebranded and became the Premier League. But yeah, really, really good documentary for fans of any club. I recommend that. In terms of soccer watching, I'll get to the Bundesliga in a second, but Wednesday saw the restart of the Portuguese League, the Primeira League, also known as Liga NOS. for sponsorship reasons. But I watched Famalicão against Porto, which, I mean, when Porto is playing, you always expect Porto to win. They're in first place, and they lost. So now the title race is wide open. This match was live on Gol TV, both in English and Spanish. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again, but the English language commentators on Gol TV are so bad. I mean, just absolutely awful. I mean, broken English. Within the first 30 seconds of the game, the commentator in his broken English said, "You mean, look at Porto. They made it into the end zone." And this is somebody who's, it's obviously either a Spanish speaker or a Portuguese speaker natively. And then just kind of butchering the English language commentary. It was so bad, I went ahead and actually switched it back to Gol TV en Español, in Spanish, and then just listened to and watched the game with a Spanish commentary. But the game was pretty good. I mean, the level of, I mean, you can tell that the players are still kind of getting back into things, but it's going to take a little bit of time to get them back to the same levels as they were before. And there was no crowd noise. It was just the players. The only major difference is they had the PA going. So as soon as a goal was scored, the PA began playing music, even though there's no one in the stadium. That was a little bit different, but overall, pretty good, pretty good. I mean, it's not the highest level of football, but it's football, and I love it. Kartik, the Bundesliga. Okay, so speaking of love, I love the Bundesliga. I love the history, the goals. I mean, we've seen so many goals since the season restarted. But I'm beginning to kind of go back to what I've always thought about the Bundesliga, where this is not football as it's meant to be. It's Bayern Munich running away with a title. They have a plus 58 goal difference. And it's not just that they're winning matches. I mean, they're beating teams, what, 5-0, 6-0. I mean, just...
And it feels like 12-0, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
These matches. Yeah, yeah.
And then the other thing, too, is I can't think of any upsets or shocks we've seen since the restart. I mean, it's the level of football is good. It's high quality. The production's great. It's just the teams that are bad are bad. The teams that are good, and there's very little shock or upsets from what we've seen.
Yeah, let me chime in on this, because I watched the Bundesliga closely and have made this observation privately to people and actually publicly, and then parked it when the restart came and became kind of a cheerleader because I love the league. What we have seen in the last few years in the Bundesliga is this desire of teams at the bottom of the table to play football, to play their way out of trouble. And Fortuna Dusseldorf, classic in this match. They're building from the back. They're trying to play like nice passing triangles at the Allianz against Bayern. I mean, you know, I know you and I complain that when we watch the Premier League and we get a top of the table versus a bottom of the table clash, and inevitably the team at the bottom of the table sits back and bunkers and absorbs pressure and sticks eight guys behind the ball. But at least that keeps the matches competitive. Usually the better team, the top team wins, right? But they have to grind it out. This is something that's been going on in the Bundesliga for two or three years, Chris, as someone who watches the league closely. And in that period, you've seen, and it happened last year too. That's why Borussia Dortmund and Bayern, I don't know what their goal differences were last season, but it was probably similar. And they ran away from the rest of the league, those two teams. This year, it's been a little more competitive because Bayern started poorly. But again, you're seeing generally, and this happens with Leverkusen too when they're on, under Peter Bosz. Generally, Leverkusen, Leipzig when they're on, Leipzig and Leverkusen when they're on, Dortmund and Bayern are beating teams 4-1, 5-1, 6-1, 5-0, 4-0, 4-0. So what you are seeing is a league where teams are all playing a similar style of football, which then inevitably the better team wins, or the team with the higher payroll, the better team, the more quality. And two, it leads to my continued concern, and I was ripped on this 12 months ago, 8 to 12 months ago, when I would post about it, that the defending in the Bundesliga is not really that much better than even Major League Soccer when it comes down to it. Now, maybe the attacking play is so much better that it shows up the defending, but I think now everyone's getting a taste of my critiques of the quality of play, not quality of play, because the play is quality, but the style of play and the growing gap between the top four or five in the league and everybody else, which was a Premier League problem until recently. Now the Bundesliga has a bigger problem, I think, than any league because it's such an attack-oriented league with everybody playing the same way. In Italy, if there's a growing gap between top and bottom, which there has been, and there has been in every European league, it's still the style of play, the tactics in that league still lend itself to Juventus and Napoli having to grind out results from time to time. Bayern doesn't have to grind out any results unless they're playing, unless the top four or five are playing one another. There's no grinding out of results going on.
Yeah, pretty much the only grinding out was that the 1-0 De Clasico victory. I mean, after they got the goal
against
Dortmund, right?
Yeah, so it's the same thing. Dortmund. So I'll give you this example: since the winter break, Dortmund has dropped points in only two matches, which were their two losses, which were to Leverkusen 4-3 in a classic Leverkusen Dortmund game because of how good those teams are attacking wise, and that their Clasico 1-0. Otherwise, their matches haven't even been competitive. If you go look, Dortmund's winning every match 3-0, 4-0, 5-0, and yet Lucien Favre is going to get sacked, it appears, just because he can't beat Bayern. But they're still beating everyone else 4-0 right. or 5-0. So I'm with you. And to me, I've lost a lot of my – and I think I said this last week on the show. I lost a lot of my appetite for the league because Bayern beat Dortmund. I think the hope for so many of us was that that would at very least be a draw and we would have a title race to the end. Now, Bayern – is firing on all cylinders. I think you have to say Müller and Kimmich are two of the best players in their position in the world. And for Müller, it's a renaissance. And then Lewandowski obviously is the best number nine in the world. So it's nice to watch from that perspective, but I don't like watching teams win 5-0 every week. That's mm-hmm. a problem.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in the TV ratings a little bit too, because those numbers reflect the really the kind of the predictability of the Bundesliga. The numbers each week are dropping, getting lower and lower. So from, I mean, when it restarted, we were in the 300s. Now we're in the 250s. So it's that does reflect kind of the, I think people enjoy watching the games, and I enjoy watching them too, because, I mean, now other than the Portuguese league and the Costa Rican league, this is pretty much all that's on. And I love the games. I just would like it to be more competitive. It reminds me, it reminds me of Major League Soccer, but it's a completely different format. At least there's the relegation battle going on. And you had that too with the Schalke game, where that one at least was against who was that against? That was against Bremen. That was it was scrappy. It was ugly. It was physical. And then Bremen getting that one goal and holding on for the victory there. So the relegation games are the ones that kind of seem to be more full blooded. But then they're not as attractive to the eye, but they are exciting from trying to see, okay, is Schalke going to get threatened to get pulled into a relegation area, or is Bremen going to get out of the relegation zone? Schalke should be fine, but Bremen, obviously, that win there helps them a lot. But in that game, though, Kartik, and actually over the weekend, we saw that Fox has changed their strategy a little bit with the halftime. I guess with Rob Stone, Alexi Lalas, and Stu Holden doing the weekly remote of Fox Soccer Indoor, the show. They must also be taping some of some things for the Bundesliga too. And it's a bit strange having Rob Stone talking about the Bundesliga, because from what I can remember, I don't think Rob Stone's touched the Bundesliga since Fox had the rights since 2015. You know, it's always, you mean, whether it's Ian Joy or somebody else, but Lalas and Holden have been there. But what they've been doing is at halftime doing a top five Bundesliga goals. And it's just, I mean, a recorded segment of, I don't know, like 30 seconds to a minute and just playing that, as well as an interview that they did with Tyler Adams. But other than that, it's still the world feed and the commentary is still good, so no complaints there. Anything else, Kartik, before we move on to the news section?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. I mean, the one thing I would say, though, is that I think the Bundesliga seems to have done a good job with the fact that since they were the only top league really playing to kind of spread out the matches. So you have matches on Mondays, you have matches on Wednesdays. The Bundesliga, for those of you who don't know, have had a huge fan backlash, supporter backlash against Monday night matches. And those will be going away in the next TV package. So, but it is kind of nice that in this era where they're not having crowds and they're needing to get the season done and they're needing to put matches on television, they're using weeknights to do it as well. So that's something that don't get too used to it. I mean, obviously the Premier League and La Liga are planning to do the same thing, but don't get too used to it with the Bundesliga because that is a league that has a cultural aversion, or their supporters have a cultural aversion to weeknight matches.
Yeah, it still feels a lot like the previous schedule, though, for the Bundesliga before the coronavirus, where it is very predictable, which with predictability as far as TV viewing, that actually helps. Yeah. As far as, say, Major League Soccer, where it's seems to be a very random. You don't know which teams are going to be on which channels on which days at which times. The Bundesliga is very predictable with their TV times. But let's move on to TV streaming news. And Kartik, this is big news over the weekend. At times, we didn't think this would happen. This could have had huge ramifications, but a deal was struck.
Yeah, so I'll admit, I mean, we're talking about what we viewed this week. I probably spent more time on the phone this week talking to sources and people with knowledge in the game domestically than actually watching football about the situation in both MLS and USL. Let's focus on MLS because this thing blew up over the weekend. And the MLS Players Union and the league have agreed to a collective bargaining agreement, and this tournament in Orlando will take place, apparently. MLS players will get a share of the revenues from the new TV rights deal, 12.5% in 2023. Remember, this current deal ends in 2022, and 25% in 2024 and onwards. For reference, NBA, NFL, and MLB players get nearly 50% of their share of the TV rights deal. Now, Don Garber then controversially says when they announced this on Wednesday, quote, "Major League Soccer will take a $1 billion revenue hit due to the pandemic," unquote, which just created all kinds of backlash because people were thinking, well, if there's $1 billion in revenue, then you've probably been misleading the public and the players in the past, in past CBA negotiations about the financial health of Major League Soccer. Garber says there will be more cameras, audio, and tech in Orlando than the typical MLS game broadcast. And in fact, ESPN will produce everything and will deliver broadcastable streams and broadcastable production to Fox and Univision for the matches they're carrying. They are also obviously rights holders. MLS Cup Final, according to Mark Abbott, the deputy commissioner, could be held in late December. It's possible that the season could go into the 2021 calendar year. Let me mention over the weekend what happened was the MLS players had previously agreed to a force majeure clause in the event that there was a second coronavirus wave, which I think a lot of people are thinking is likely. There's not, or even after the Orlando tournament, there'll be a gap because of coronavirus until we can restart the actual scheduled 2020 season. And so they had agreed to that. They had agreed to that in goodwill. They had given a lot of ground, is what players and player agents told me on background. Then suddenly Major League Soccer, because of this potential of maybe having to push the season off into 2021, which they've now concluding in 2021, which they've now publicly acknowledged, said, okay, we're going to need even more concession. This is after they had agreed a deal that would essentially start the Orlando tournament. So the players said no. And Chris, MLS decided they would lock out the players if a deal wasn't reached by Tuesday. Now, what was really stunning was that in the past, when management has taken that sort of hard line with the players' union, one, the players' union has buckled, and two, public opinion, because MLS has a lot of I don't know even how to describe them. You know, you and I know what we're talking about, and we've talked about those types of fans a lot, and a lot of media that's very complicit, a lot of fans that are more concerned about the corporate health of MLS than the financial health and player safety issues, those sort of things. A lot of people are just MLS fans. So generally, you've had these fans kind of close ranks with league management. That did not happen this time. In fact, there was a massive backlash. I mean, I can't even describe how big the backlash was by even typical people who close ranks with MLS. Maybe it had something to do with what was going on in the country, the civil disobedience, the protests. Everybody was kind of in a belligerent mood anyway to take on authority. That might have had something to do with it, but it was actually stunning. And I think it caught MLS's I don't know about the New York executives of the league, but I know it caught some of the people at teams that I spoke to on background off guard. They did not expect that. So yeah. They ended up caving, which is quite stunning because I think, one, there's some bad will that came out of it that is not going to just go away overnight. And two, it probably puts the players' union in a stronger position than they've ever been and shows that perhaps in the past, if they had stood up when they quite frankly caved in the negotiations, especially in 2015 on that CBA, that maybe they would have gotten more. But, you know, good job to them. I'm glad this has been resolved, and we're going to have a tournament in Orlando, and I know you have some thoughts about that.
Yeah, well, the good news is that Major League Soccer will be back. It's good to know that the players will get a chance to play, and we will get to see some football, soccer, live on television. And it's going to be, I mean, the games are going to be, I think, a couple of games early in the morning and a couple of games later in the evening in prime time. So a good opportunity here for ESPN and Fox and Univision. I wonder, though, Kartik, before we talk about the optics of this tournament, I wonder, though, the 12.5% revenue share for 2023 and then 25% in 2024 and onwards. So from 2024 and onwards, 25%, that's great. The 12.5%, I wonder if that is whether it's a indication, perhaps, that maybe MLS will try to renew the current TV deals for one more year before they go ahead and open up for bidding.
There has been some speculation about that, so continue.
No, go ahead, because that's just a thought.
There was some speculation. And this was before the deal was reached. So I talked to over a dozen people this between Saturday and Tuesday, and then Saturday and Tuesday morning, and have not circled back since the deal was agreed. But there was a feeling that maybe MLS, because of the diminishing sum revenues also, which is something you pointed out on last week's show, Chris, and hadn't been really talked about in mass until this point, because of the diminishing revenues from some friendlies and some internationals, that they might just seek to extend, roll over this deal to 2023 or 2024. They don't want to extend it too long term because they have CBS, they have Amazon, they have Turner, they have other people who might want to bid on DAZN, who might want to bid on MLS rights. At the same time, there's an acknowledgement that maybe going to market now with internationals shut down might be really poor timing. So there is a possibility that this happens.
And that's the thing, though, too, Kartik. Club soccer is something that we can all watch those games since those leagues are starting to come back. International football, national teams playing, that's a whole other ball game because you kind of think of, say, the United States. So, I think wasn't it this summer that they were talking about having some of the teams from overseas come into the United States and play in some type of friendly tournament? Or, you mean, imagine if the U.S. went ahead and invited, say, England, I don't know, Italy, Spain, and Germany, said, hey, come on over to the United States. I think most of those national federations would say absolutely no chance are we coming to the United States with what's going on with the coronavirus and what's going on with the civil unrest. Thanks, but no thanks. We're concentrating on club soccer. The national game or the national team is kind of not even in the picture right now. And vice versa, too. I mean, I'm sure the U.S. is probably thinking, like the U.S. Soccer Federation, as far as the men and the women, probably it's going to be a while before they go ahead and start having those teams play in other countries, too. There's so much to get through to get to that point, and we're still focusing on the club soccer side of things. But then, yeah, that's a good point. But my take, Kartik, on this whole thing, too, is that so this tournament in Orlando, which is good news that it's going to happen – it's going to be very much like a World Cup tournament. So you'll have all the teams coming down to Orlando in, about June 24th, training for a couple of weeks, and then around about July 9th, beginning this tournament, being split up, each team into different groups, and having a mini World Cup tournament. So after three games in that first round, the top teams advance, and the teams that were lower down, that didn't get as many points, they go home. And then you're down to 16 teams, and then those 16 teams go ahead and play out that tournament to win it and see who's the champion. In theory, that makes a lot of sense, because what else are you going to do? Are you going to try to play league games, which I'm trying to get as many league games in throughout the season, but that's not as attractive for the TV viewer. My concern, though, Kartik, is the optics of this. Is you and I have both been to the ESPN Wide World of Sports facility many times. I've probably been there a dozen times. It's a facility that's meant for youth soccer. I mean, youth sports. I mean, they play baseball there, they play basketball there, they play soccer there. But there's over 20 fields. It's set up for youth soccer. So I think there's one stand or maybe two stands in the complex. The biggest stand probably holds about maybe 1,000 people tops. And again, there won't be any fans there. But from the optics, from having the cameras there, and Don Garber was talking about having more cameras than an MLS game, is that facility is wide, expansive, open. It's not very pretty to look at from a television perspective. Now, you've got the Bundesliga. Yes, there's no fans in the stadium, but at least those games are being played in those home stadiums of those clubs. And like Gladbach, for example, are having the cardboard cutouts of the fans. I think it's Cologne is having kind of the shirts on the seats to make it look, add some atmosphere of color to it. But in Orlando, there's going to be nothing. So, yes, you might have artificial crowd noise piped in, which I'm sure you would. But I think everyone will watch that tournament probably the first day or two. But after that, Kartik, I just wonder how much desire is there to watch the rest of the tournament if the look and feel of this is going to look like you're playing at a youth soccer facility for the rest of I think it's like 30 days that they'll be there.
Yeah, and I have to say I'd express the same concern for the NBA because I've actually gone to – they're going to use the HP Pavilion, which is right – you walk right by it, right, when you walk to the youth soccer fields. And, in fact, you use the changing rooms in there sometimes. I've gone to college basketball games in the Disney tournament, whatever it's called, Milk Challenge, I think it was called at one point, there. And it's not even an adequate facility, quite frankly, for college basketball. So I don't know the NBA is going to play there. But similarly the soccer fields we've had, I think I mentioned before, we had a friendly between Schalke and Fort Lauderdale Strikers at the stadium field, at one of the stadium fields at Disney, and the pitch condition was complained about by Schalke. They didn't like the condition of the pitch. They didn't like the condition of the training facilities, which is part – and I think maybe this is the first time I'm talking about this 4 years later. This is a big part of the reason they didn't come back to the Florida Cup after that. So those training facilities, which MLS teams are going to train on, that stadium pitch, which they're going to play on, and they're going to have to play on multiple stadium pitches, right, because there are going to be games going on all day long, and there's going to need to be some significant groundskeeping done to those facilities, are going to need to be in tip-top shape. I do not think they're necessarily at the level of MLS stadium pitches to begin with. Then they're going to be torn up more frequently, or MLS training pitches to begin with. So this is a big concern. There's been talk, and I don't know what's going to happen. We don't know the full details of the tournament yet in terms of venues. There has been talk of maybe busing players off of the Disney campus, out of the Wide World of Sports complex, and using some of the better soccer facilities, Lake Nona, among others. Champions Gate. Right. Yeah, Champions Gate MLS has used a lot for preseason and for exhibition matches in preseason. MLS teams have, so they're very familiar with Champions Gate. And the training facilities at Champions Gate are better. It's a better pitch to train on. But then you tear up the game field, or maybe even up to Seminole County in Lake Mary. That's too far right.
I don't see it happening. I see it as a lockdown and just tight security. You mean buses from the Coronado Hotel directly to the ESPN Wide World of Sports, back and forth between there, and that's it. Even though there's better pitches and better facilities elsewhere, it's just, I think it's just too much of a risk.
So then, Chris, if that's the case, and you and I both know the Disney complex, well, we both know all of these facilities. We're talking about Lake Nona, et cetera, Champions Gate. They are sacrificing, and I think safety needs to come first, but because they're trying to be first to market among major American men's pro leagues, obviously NWSL we know is going to start now probably about 10 days, if not NWSL starting June 27th, it might end up being 10 or 10 days or 2 weeks before MLS, that they are sacrificing the optics for player safety, but they're still trying to rush the market. So there's like this kind of balancing act they're trying to undertake. Disney then, I think it's now, how many weeks out will we be? We're about a month out, or 3 weeks out from them going there to train. Disney is going to have to really, really work and upgrade their facilities. Not the facilities as much as the pitches in the next 3 weeks.
Yeah, ESPN especially has a difficult job ahead of them because they're going to be the ones that are going to be producing these games and providing the footage. And then Fox and Univision, for whichever games they're going to be showing, are going to be taking that ESPN feed and then adding on their graphics and adding on their commentators. But effectively, it's produced by ESPN. And the games that are on ESPN or ESPN2, those, of course, will use their ESPN feed there too. So the challenge, I have confidence in ESPN that they will do everything possible to make this as pleasant of a TV experience as possible. This is going to be a big challenge. This is a huge challenge. La Liga has been talking about having not just artificial crowd noise when the league starts next week, but also having a virtual crowd where almost like FIFA 20, the video game, having virtual fans in the stadium. I'm not sure if ESPN and MLS is going to go to that extent where they're going to create a stadium virtually and then make it look and feel like this a stadium. I mean, that's a huge undertaking, especially when there's no stadium there to kind of build on virtually. That's going to be almost impossible, I would think. But I'm sure they will try their hardest to make this as good of a TV viewing product as possible. The other optics, though, too, Kartik, too, is that you have to think this is going to be a global product. This is not just Major League Soccer on Univision, Fox, and ESPN, but Sky Sports News. Sky Sports broadcasts MLS games. Asia, MLS games are there, too. Around the world, MLS games are televised. So, again, I'm sure using the ESPN as a world feed and then having their broadcasters on top of that remotely, that's another thing in terms of the optics. So the optics are that this could end up looking like a bunch of scrimmages, a bunch of games where the first day or two, it's exciting. But then after that, what's the meaning of this? This tournament, at the end of the day, Kartik, This tournament is meaningless. I mean, yes, there's talk about perhaps the winner having a qualification into the CONCACAF Champions League. At the same time, the CONCACAF Champions League is relatively meaningless. It's something that's dominated by Liga MX clubs. Is not something that generates large viewing numbers for any season. So, what is the meaning of this tournament? I mean, from a business perspective, we know that Major League Soccer has to go ahead with this tournament and get back on television because, like Don Garber says, however those numbers are put together, a loss of $1 billion. So is that some and Major League Soccer? I would imagine so. And what is he taking into account in regards to that loss? And is that for this year only? Because next year is going to be a tough year too. Next year is not going to be all back to normal. 50,000 fans in the Atlanta Stadium or Seattle Stadium. So there's a lot of issues with this. And I think at the end of the day, Kartik, yes, the idea of a World Cup tournament is fantastic. But with a World Cup, there's a lot more that goes into that. You have, history. You've got the passion. You've got the rivals between, say, I don't know, a Germany and a Holland, where it's basically war off the pitch and on the pitch. You've got this built up national pride from all these different countries from around the world, and the quality of football is usually in the World Cup is usually not the best, but is definitely high. It's exceptional. And with this Major League Soccer tournament, you've got teams with no identity nationally. You've got imagine this tournament, Kartik, and imagine if you had Colorado Rapids against San Jose, or you had Real Salt Lake against Sporting Kansas City. Now, if you live in those cities, yes, you'd be interested and you're fans of those clubs. But nationally, I think there's very little interest. Internationally, even less interest. Or maybe you have the New York Red Bulls, who aren't even from New York, against Inter Miami, who aren't even from Miami, playing against each other. And yes, there will be interest, but I don't see that there will be a lot of national interest in this, even though it'll be the first men's league coming back, even though these games will be in prime time, oftentimes on ESPN and probably Fox and probably Univision. I just wonder the identity of these clubs. I think that's been an issue all along, even before the coronavirus, is with Major League Soccer. They've had a tough issue with clubs. The majority of clubs have no identity. I mean, you kind of look at a Real Salt Lake. I mean, what is that club about? I mean, tell me about the fans. Tell me about the history of the club. Tell me about the things that make Real Salt Lake different than any other club. But you look at the Premier League and you can pick any of those 20 clubs, and each of those clubs has a different identity, has a different different feel to the fan base. Each of them is completely separate. And with Major League Soccer, it's very much, except for your Seattles or Atlantas or LAFCs, the rare exceptions, it's very not much identity nationally. So I'm concerned about the TV numbers and what the TV numbers will be.
Yeah, nonetheless, whatever the case is with that, I think MLS had to get creative. They had to do something to get this season or get fulfill TV obligations, get some football under their belts, and hedge against a potential second wave. Because I think the concern was that even if you restart the season, your regularly scheduled season, and just pick up the fixtures where we left off in March. One, there are restrictions on having events in certain states, but two, even if you brought them to a neutral site and you resume that, you would be in a situation where there's very likely, at least in some of the places where MLS has clubs, a second wave that's going to happen. So right. I think they tried to get creative. I give them a lot of credit for that. And the existing format to grab is a Euro or a World Cup format, right? So maybe they didn't get too creative. They just took an international football format and created a cup competition out of it. This all having been said, you know, I kind of agree with some of your criticisms, which is there may not be it really depends who goes through in this tournament. If there are – because there are – when you're talking about a group stage of three matches, results, one bad result, and teams not training for all this time until recently, there could be some very random results. So you could end up, instead of having what I think MLS would hope would be, let's just say a Seattle-Atlanta final, and Seattle-Atlanta progressing through this whole competition, round of six, group stage, round of 16, eights, fours, twos, you would have Colorado versus San Jose, the scenario you mentioned.
Right.
So that's the concern. I think the television ratings will very much be contingent, and we have said this before on this show, and people get angry when we say it. MLS fans get angry. Seattle and Atlanta drive TV numbers in a way that the other clubs in the league just don't. Maybe LAFC to a lesser extent, but it's Seattle and Atlanta. They need those two teams to do as well as they can in this competition. If they do, when you add in the casual sports fan who doesn't have other primetime viewing, I think the ratings will be quite good. If it ends up being Colorado, San Jose, I think Minnesota has a very good team this year. Minnesota could be a team that wins this thing, but I don't know that they have any sort of national appeal right now. If the Houston Dynamo by some chance do really well, or Dallas, that's not good for MLS. So I think, unfortunately, the league has tried very hard to keep some sort of enforced parity, some sort of one-size-fits-all cookie-cutter philosophy about a lot of these clubs, but we have clubs. Seattle has a history going back to the 1970s. Atlanta has got this thing going on. There were clubs like Atlanta, Portland, I need to mention, under Merritt Paulson, yep. Seattle, and one or two others that have an outsized supporters base and actually can appeal to soccer fans in addition to casual sports fans in a way that other MLS clubs can't. So MLS is going to need, in considering they're throwing – this is a huge gamble in terms of just their presence and trying to kickstart this thing. They're going to need those clubs to do as well as possible. I can't stress that enough. I think they are reliant on Seattle and Atlanta and Portland. Let's say those three clubs doing really well in this tournament.
Yeah, and those clubs all have an identity. And it's not just the fan base, but it's also just a playing style, kind of a style of play that you can say, okay, that is a quintessential.
Atlanta has, yeah.
Right,
Atlanta
right.
very clearly, I think from the very beginning, and this goes back maybe to bringing in Darren Eales from Spurs, right? Mm-hmm. Bringing in an executive who had a lot of experience in England and in Europe, that he right away wanted a DNA in that club rather than just throwing a bunch of guys out and playing like every other team in MLS. So Atlanta – so for those of you who have not watched MLS much, I would highly recommend you in this tournament you check out Atlanta because the style of play under DeBoer – resembles a lot of what you see in the Netherlands and Spain, and their playing principles are like right. that. Most MLS clubs, they just, I don't know, they're pragmatic. It's the opposite of the Bundesliga,
yeah.
right? The Bundesliga, they all have this very nice way of playing. The MLS, most of the teams just bunker guys behind the ball, and it's very hard on the eye at times.
And within Atlanta, I mean, Atlanta United has an identity within, I mean, different cities, Seattle Sounders have an identity. It's just when you get outside of those cities and you look at the entire nation of the country and you look at the United States and say, okay, what is going to, I don't know, a fan from Louisiana, I mean, what is that fan going to gravitate towards when there's no team near them? I mean, you've got the same thing too with Premier League clubs, that's just one example, but you have, it seems to be, I mean, from me going to FanFest, some of these fans who have probably never set foot overseas into, say, the United Kingdom or into Europe or wherever, have a very close identity with that club, that they identify with, say, Liverpool, and they know the history, they know what makes them unique, and they're I mean, kind of locked into that. I don't see that yet with Major League Soccer, and I mean, it's 25 years now, and it just seems to be very much just that parity, other than the rare exceptions, kind of creates a lot of teams that just, you know, almost the kits. I mean, the kits look very much like replicates, just like they look very similar, some of these kits, but this,
well,
this...
well that's part of the problem. Okay, I'm sorry
go ahead.
To jump in, but the Adidas, the fact that MLS has every club wearing Adidas kits is part of the reason the identity gets lost.
Yeah.
And in the early days of MLS, to their credit, even though it was always a single entity league, clubs went out and negotiated their own deals. So I was talking about this with someone this past week, that there was really some cool Kappa kits in the league. There was Umbro, obviously, with the Fusion, which you've talked about. There were some really cool Nike kits. But then once the league made a deal with Adidas in the early 2000s to put everybody in Adidas kits, the kits have gotten more and more boring and just generic and kind of cuts the DNA also of teams.
Right, absolutely. And with this tournament, to me, it feels more like a contractual obligation. It doesn't feel like a organic, authentic tournament that's been created. I get it from MLS's perspective. They have to get back in the game. I mean, they're losing money and they need to go ahead and fulfill the contractual obligation for the TV companies, but also the sponsorships, and maybe even add some sponsorships for this tournament. But the whole thing seems very fake. I mean, this is something that's been created out of nothing. In future years, will any of us remember who won the 2020, whatever it's going to be called, cup from Orlando?
Will it be like Superliga? Look, I I liked Super League. I actually am one of the few people who would still say, hey, I really enjoyed the Super League tournament. Some did for three or four years in the late from 2007 to like 2010. They even flew Howard Webb over for one of the who's now actually works for MLS, but at the time was the top official maybe in the world. They actually flew him over for a final of one of those tournaments. And but if you talk about Superliga now, who won Superliga? You know, did you, do you remember Superliga? It's a no.
Yeah.
No one remembers
yeah.
it.
Yeah, I will always forget it until you mention it every time.
Yeah, but I actually enjoyed it. I mean,
yeah,
I've
heard
good
things
too.
I made
a bigger deal out of it than maybe anyone else in the media at the time. Even I forget who won it. I mean, I guess the that's the problem is that these unless you have some consistency. There was also, Chris, I don't know if you remember this, the Pan Pacific Cup that some put together with the K League and the J League and the A League, and it, the whole idea was to showcase David Beckham in these places.
Right.
And unfortunately for MLS, what we learned was MLS teams could compete with A-League teams and maybe a K-League team, but the J-League was way, 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 way beyond MLS in that tournament, and that got very quietly canceled. So they've had these kind of ideas, these concepts, which I thought were kind of cool. I thought Trans-Pacific was like a really good idea,
but
MLS teams couldn't win it, and was kind of maybe the same thing with Superliga,
right.
they shelved it.
But Kartik, out of all the leagues worldwide, I mean, you look at Asia, you look at Europe, you look at South America, you look at North America, Major League Soccer, probably the pandemic hit at the absolute worst time for Major League Soccer. I mean, the leagues in Europe were almost done. The leagues in other countries don't rely as much on attendance revenue. So if yes. they go and if they go ahead and say, okay, we're going to abandon the league or we're going to suspend the league, that's not as much of an issue as it is for Major League Soccer. So Major League Soccer having only played like what, 2 to 3 games, I think two games in this season. I mean, in theory, it's probably the wisest decision would have been to go ahead and just say, we're abandoning the entire season. We're going to come back strong back in, maybe start a little bit earlier, maybe start in early February or something like that, and play next season and play the whole way through. So this thing that they're creating, which I just have a lot of concerns about this one as far as the appeal of this, like the sporting merits of this. I mean, what is this? This almost feels like what crystallizes the whole regular season of Major League Soccer, where it's pretty much meaningless. I mean, yes, about 50% of the teams go ahead and make it into the playoffs. This is almost kind of a stopgap measure to try to get MLS to the point of the playoffs and then hoping that by the fall that things will be better, where games can be played and they can somehow put together some playoff system that will lead to an MLS Cup, and then MLS Cup is, you know, kind of where the champions are named. But the whole process of this is, I mean, they're hoping for that. And Mark Abbott saying, like you said to Kartik, that we're looking at perhaps late December, maybe going into early next year to finish this season. So it all feels like contractual obligations. And that's the thing, though, too, with the title race in Europe. There's only, I mean, what, less than 10 games to go for most of the leagues. And there you've got a opportunity to finish those off and declare champions and figure out who's getting relegated, who's getting promoted, and move on from there. With MLS, it's a lot more difficult. All right, Kartik, moving on to some other news. So in terms of talking about the leagues coming back, we've discussed the Portuguese league. Serie A is going to resume on June 20th. The weekend before that, Coppa Italia semifinals on June 13th or June 14th are scheduled to kick off. The actual the Serie A schedule for the first couple of weeks, I think we have at worldsoccertalk.com. Also on June 20th, the championship is back. And as of recording of this podcast on Thursday, we don't have the schedule yet for those games, but the championship in England is back. And then Major League Soccer, tentatively now we're looking at what was originally July 1st. We're looking now at about July 9th for the tournament to kick off. And Kartik, in brighter news, there's some big news coming next week for fans of German soccer.
Yeah, so the German Cup semifinals, both of them, will be on – B big ESPN and on ESPN Deportes, which is quite different than the than what we've seen from Fox. They're putting and they're going to they've already put some promotion behind this on the ESPN FC program. A big contrast with Fox. And there's been a lot of concern that they're only four games contractually, right, in the Bundesliga contract starting next year that will be put on broadcast television or on over the air television. However, now you're beginning to see ESPN has some flexibility, right? They're pragmatic in seeing, okay, there's some demand for this. Why don't we put these games on regular ESPN? Also, I should say that I've heard from multiple people, multiple sources, that there is a good possibility when Serie A returns, which you just talked about a moment ago, that we will see more games on ESPN and ESPN2 and ESPN News than we're accustomed to seeing. So that's all very good news and shows ESPN's pragmatism, even though they're having the same financial issues, even though they're having the same staff cutbacks as Fox. There is a larger institutional commitment to doing things properly. Is that the right word? I'm sorry, that sounds really condescending to Fox. Maybe that's too strong, but doing things in a more presentable way, let's say that way.
Yeah, and ESPN has had the rights to the DFB Pokal Cup, the German Cup, for a few years now too. So this is not part of the actual deal for the Bundesliga. But for those who are interested, go to our website, worldsoccertalk.com, and you'll see the schedule for the games on Tuesday and Wednesday in those semifinals, which are often great games. And there I can see those games being a lot more competitive than the league itself so far this year. Last but not least, Kartik, big changes at Fanatis, which is the legal streaming service. They have headquartered in Miami, and they've been around since 2017. What they've announced this week is that they've added an Android app, so you'll be able to, if you have a smart TV, be able to watch Fanatis through the app through certain smart TVs. But on top of that, too, they've added a freemium version. So it's a free version. All that's required is just an email address and no credit cards, and you'll get access to Real Madrid TV, Sevilla TV, and a few other channels. And the Real Madrid TV and Sevilla TV is 24/7. So if you're into Spanish soccer, want to learn more about Spanish soccer, that's the place to go. And then last but not least, with Fanatis, they've completely rebranded and redesigned the website and apps too. It looks very modern, looks really, really good. And we've got an interview with the CEO of Fanatis. It goes into more detail. It's $8 a month, and you get beIN Sports, all the beIN Sports channels, including the beIN Sports Connect channels, as well as Goal TV, as well as TYC Sports International. And when it comes back, you get Superliga Argentina, so you get the River Boca games. A lot of great value for just $8 a month. Moving on to TV ratings, Kartik, we didn't get a chance last week to talk about the number for the Clásica with Dortmund and Bayern Munich, because we didn't have it in time for the podcast. But that one was live on FS1, and it was on a Tuesday. That one was actually, do I have the number? I do have the number here somewhere. Let me look that up real fast. And I lost it. Anyway, I think it was about 300,000 people watched that game, which is good. It's a good number. I mean, that's the biggest, I mean, obviously the biggest game in the Bundesliga. But from last weekend, there were actually more people that watched Dortmund than they watched Bayern Munich, which is interesting. So we had 250,000 people that watched Paderborn against Dortmund, the 6-1 game on FS1 on Sunday, compared to Bayern Munich against Fortuna Düsseldorf on the Saturday, 246,000 viewers.
Yeah.
So Dortmund has the edge in that one, even though Erling Haaland was injured for that one. But other than those games, Schalke against Bremen, 130,000. Gladbach against Union Berlin, 118,000. And then the Friday game, which was Freiburg against Leverkusen, and that was 41,000 on FS2.
And, and, And the U.S. Narrative isn't carrying these matches because the 130,000 for Schalke versus Bremen is a low number when you had two
U.S. derby, basically.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, right. You had two U.S. Players prominently starting for those clubs. So that that in itself is very, very disappointing. I think this is something that also NBC has learned the hard way with their Pulisic mania, that maybe U.S. men's national team players just don't they don't drive ratings the way U.S. women's national team players do. There's just not much interest in the in these guys. And I think when you see Leipzig's ratings with Tyler Adams, maybe the top U.S. men's player right now, I don't think it makes any difference whether he plays or not. Right. Leipzig's a good team and they're going to probably get the same viewing number in the U.S. regardless. So that's another indicator.
Yeah, overall, I mean, we've talked about the Bundesliga becoming a little bit predictable and the title race is over, effectively. I mean, really, not mathematically. And yes, the relegation battle is on, but
sort of on.
Yeah, yeah. But the numbers each week are dropping.
It's a race for the playoffs. Yeah, the two teams that are going to go straight down, we know already. That's another problem, actually.
Right, and it looks like Hamburg and one other team from the second division, looking like they're probably going to be in the playoffs to try to get back into the Bundesliga. But yeah, I mean the numbers are dropping week after week, and that's not good. I mean, you would think that the Bundesliga being practically the only game in town, that those numbers would stay the same or increase week after week, but it does paint a picture of an issue. Yeah. All right, Kartik, let's move on to the listener mailbag. First up is Monty Reed. Monty says, right before kickoff in the Dortmund and Bayern Munich match, the announcer stated that we would be able to hear everyone on the pitch, and instead we all heard that piped-in fake noise. Showing a stadium that is empty and playing that piped-in noise is fake. Yes, crowd noise makes the match better, but not when it is fake noise. I really, really, really do not like it. If there is no crowd in the stands, I want to hear the action on the field, the kicking of the ball, the communication of the players and the coaches. I want what is real, not some fake noise. Had the match playing in my office, and one of my co-workers came in and saw the match on, and the first thing this non-soccer watching person said, hey, what's up with this crowd noise when there's nobody in the stands? That's just wrong. So, Monty, good points there, too. And I guess looking at the TV ratings, you could probably say, well, the TV ratings, it's not really, the crowd noise is really not helping the TV ratings. I mean, I don't think the drop-off is a result of the crowd noise, but certainly not helping. For me, as a viewer, I enjoy the games more with the crowd noise, with that kind of background noise. It pulls me more into the game, but some good points there from Monty. What do you think, Kartik?
Yeah, I go back and forth on this, really. I mean, I think I think for those of us that are trying to focus on the fact that there's a match on the pitch, it's very natural to hear that crowd noise. And so during that match, that specific match, it felt more natural and helped me kind of get into the match. But at the same time, for other matches, it seems very phony, right? It just doesn't seem right. We all know the situation. I think the Dortmund-Bayern game was just such a big match that it was maybe we felt differently about it. But I kind of see it both ways.
Yeah, I like it personally, and I think it's a wise idea, and I believe, I'm sure the Premier League will do it, as La Liga will, as Major League Soccer will, so I think it's here to stay. Because for the TV viewer, you mean, having that game on in a bar, and just having the silence, and having the ball kicked, and then the commentators is not a very TV-friendly product, unfortunately, and that's the day and age that we're in, is it is very much a TV product. At least for those who are not in the stadium, and nobody's at the stadium now anyway. So next up is Yannick Rampke. And Yannick says, ESPN Plus has $30 million reasons a year to make the Bundesliga worth their money and put forth more effort than Fox, for whom the United States was a throw-in an 80-territory deal in 2015. Serie A's coverage isn't encouraging, but deal was brokered by intermediating IMG, the DFL talked directly to ESPN before. And those are good points, because it does feel like that Fox is treating the Bundesliga like filler, that they didn't have the buy-in, that like Fox Sports USA didn't seem to be the one pushing to get the Bundesliga. It was a 80 country deal, and the United States was included in that, and that's felt the whole way since 2015 to 2020. Right now, it's felt like they've kind of been thrown at them, and they have to try to do the best with what they have. But it's not a top priority. Next up is Robert. Robert says, "You are correct. The MLS is facing some serious issues. Whatever is planned to replace the season, it will not bring in much revenue. Even after the worst of this pandemic is over, people will may be afraid to return to stadiums. It will be most likely next year before there is a vaccine. And unless if it's shown for some reason, say, they will never get the shot and are willing to put others in danger, this does not make the future very bright for world soccer and sports in general." And yeah, when this coronavirus kind of erupted, especially in Italy, and kind of caused the shutdown, we had a podcast that was talking about how the coronavirus was going to have huge impacts, damaging impacts on soccer globally. And we're still haven't felt all of it yet. I mean, and I think it's actually probably going to be much worse than I first feared, Kartik, which is not good news from all levels, from youth soccer all the way up to the highest level. And in terms of even the transfer windows, everything, I think, is a lot of companies throughout the soccer landscape have lost money and are losing tons of money. And there's a lot of fear and anxiety going on at the same time. We haven't mentioned it yet today, but DAZN, we've talked about before, going through some financial issues with their billionaire owner, are now looking to sell Goal.com, which is owned by the DAZN parent group, and I think looking for to sell that for $125 million to an investment company. So looking to kind of get some cash there to keep DAZN running and to make it viable in the future. But yeah, I think Robert's got some good points there, Kartik.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that there's you mentioned the DAZN situation. They continue to be a major player for rights outside the U.S. The assumption is if they can keep this thing going, they can bid on MLS in 2022, or if the deal is rolled over for a year or two after that. This is a very difficult time, I think, for all of soccer in the U.S. And we didn't get into USL today. Maybe we will in a future episode. But they've got some serious decisions to make. They're trying to restart the season, the American Second Division, and there is some incredible resistance from the clubs, because I think the clubs in that league are even more dependent on gate revenue, and there doesn't seem to be for some of the clubs and for MLS reserve teams the impetus, if you're not getting gate revenue, to actually kick a ball. So and who knows, based on where their clubs are, when they could actually open up to crowds again. We're probably looking at 2021. So tough times, and every league in the country is going through that. And as we talked about extensively earlier, MLS, they had to get creative with this solution for the Orlando tournament, but it's still a gamble, right? And there's still a lot to be seen. I mean, I credit to them for getting this far, but we'll see if it in fact stops the bleeding or not.
Well, one more thing about that too, Kartik, is the national teams. And you look at CONCACAF, and you look at the U.S. Soccer Federation, and you look at the FMF from Mexico, and I wonder, when is the next time that, say, a Mexico-United States game, which is a guaranteed sellout, is going to have a crowd of 50 to 60 to 70 to 80,000 people in the stadium, all packed in, paying huge prices, ticket prices for games like that. That's a cash cow for CONCACAF and for some, and U.S. soccer and the FMF. and not just U.S. and Mexico, but even the Gold Cup. And the Gold Cup, next Gold Cup is what, the summer of 2021, you're going to have teams from around the CONCACAF area region coming to the United States mostly to play games. Are those games going to be behind closed doors? If they're not behind closed doors, Will those have the same capacity, the same attendance numbers that we've seen in previous tournaments? Are the Mexican fans going to turn out in large numbers? Are the US fans going to turn out in large numbers? So it has a direct impact on a lot of these deals. And again, at the end of the day, the leagues and confederations that will benefit the most are the ones that have the largest number in revenue with TV deals. Those will be the winners as long as the games continue. The ones that are tied to the attendances are going to be in serious trouble.
So before we go here, I think where I do find some truth in Garber's 1 billion number, I think it's still disingenuous, as we've talked about, and there was so much pushback on social media, et cetera, when he said it. But I do think that he might be accounting for future losses for some, and some, which is the driver of healthy profits, I think, for Major League Soccer and Major League Soccer's clubs generally, is now going to be a money loser in 2020 and perhaps in 2021, or at least for a big, large portion of 2021. I don't think you can have that Mexico-U.S. Friendly in front of 90,000 people at the Coliseum or Rose Bowl until, I guess the lead up to the Gold Cup in 2021, or maybe it's after. I don't know. So that might be what he was trying to convey, and he got sloppy in how he conveyed it. But I think maybe he's talking about future losses and how much this pandemic is going to cost MLS and some down the road. Now, he did, I think, if I remember correctly, listening to the call, he did say so far, or he said he implied so far, which right. is an absolutely absurd notion. But I do think they are now concerned about some not being able to generate profits. They're concerned about a second wave, which is why they tried to push this force majeure clause into the CBA, which led to the showdown this past week. There's a lot of nervousness there that and I have to give you credit, Chris, because I thought they were going to have problems, but I didn't think their problems were going to be significantly worse than other sports or other leagues when we shut down in March. Now we're seeing they're in some trouble, and the way they handled the force majeure thing, the fact that they tried to push that at the last minute indicates to me, and indicates to a lot of people I've spoken to, they are in bigger trouble than we thought they were, and or that how they had represented it previously.
Yeah, and the big goal in this, all of this, the big kind of shining light at the top of this is the 2026 World Cup, and that is the cash cow that some Major League Soccer, U.S. Soccer is looking at and saying, okay, that is going to be, I mean, the biggest World Cup ever, most number of teams. And even though that is like, what, 6 years away, I mean, hopefully by then everything will be completely back to normal and things will be, I mean, just rosy. There's a lot of work to do between now and then. And there's a lot of issues that have to be, I mean, there's clubs that will go out of business. There are organizations that will go out of business. There are players that will be probably stuck without a team. And there's just small issues. There's bigger issues than that, too. There's a lot of business issues and whether leagues will continue. I mean, you look at Major League Soccer, I'm sure we'll find a way to stay afloat and keep on going. But then you mentioned the USL, you mentioned some of the other leagues, the lower leagues. That system is in jeopardy. So, I mean, this is huge. And going into this season, Kartik, the MLS season, we were talking about how MLS, this was the perfect year. They were perfectly placed. With the TV deals, with all the interest from DAZN and BR Live and CBS and Amazon and all these streaming platforms looking to acquire sports, which they still are, but those companies are still at the same time dealing with a lot of financial issues. And a DAZN, for example, is not going to be able to put in as big of a bid as they were just 3 months ago, just as one example. And everything was perfectly placed for this year to be the most successful one for MLS probably ever. Also with, of course, the League's Cup and the Liga MX MLS All-Star Game and Campeones Cup so many things to look forward to. All that is out the window. So the billion-dollar number, Don Garber's not sloppy. Everything he says, everything he does is very calculated. So he has reasons for saying those things. Now, what is that billion dollar number contain? I mean, what? How is that kind of? I mean, is that just a number on a napkin that's put together, or is that something that they've looked at for some and Major League Soccer and looking at, say, the next 12 months and the ramifications of that? And then that's the thing too, Kartik, even season tickets. I mean, if you're a season ticket holder for Major League Soccer, for any of the clubs, and you've paid for the season, and you've seen, well, for Inter Miami, zero home games. Some of these clubs, zero home games, but a bit, or maybe one home game, and you've played for the entire season. You mean, are you demanding your money back, or are you just holding on to that money for next season? There's a lot of issues there, Kartik. All right, listeners, if you have any comments, any feedback, any questions, any ideas, any observations, we would love to hear from you. We want you to have your say. You can always reach us via email through web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can post your comments on worldsoccertalk.com. You can listen to the podcast every Thursday, released on SoundCloud, Spotify, YouTube, Overcast, you name it, every single podcast player that's out there. And if you like the show, share it with your friends and rate us and review us on iTunes. We'd appreciate it there. And Kartik, heading into another weekend, we've got the Bundesliga, we've got the Portuguese league, we've got the Costa Rican league, which on Saturday night, I think Deportivo Saprissa is playing on ESPN2, and then we've got the German Cup midweek. There's a lot to look forward to. Things are getting rosier as far as the soccer expectations of what to watch. But what should they do?
Enjoy your football.